from the bottomless deep. Crowl, hear thy people.
Great Crowl!
Crowl, we summon thee.
Mighty Crowl!
Crowl, we offer this life in tribute to thy greatness.
Great Crowl!
Guide and protect us, all-powerful one, in the great struggle which lies ahead.
Crowl!
Power Time Fanboy.
Power Time Fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
PartTimeFanboy.com. This is Part-Time Fanboy. My name is Christian Horn, and I am here with Doctor Who scholar Barry Negrin, because we have finally, we are closing in on the end of the, what do you call it, like miniseries?
The Key to Time. It was the season, I think it's the 18th season of Doctor Who.
The 18th. Oh, wow. The 18th season of Doctor Who. We've been sporadically. We started off strong. We were doing them like maybe like once a month, once every couple of weeks. And then we just slowed down to a crawl.
Sorry. The 16th season. My bad.
Ah, okay. Oh, so anyone who was screaming in the background, no, it's the 16th, can shut up now. Whatchamacallit. So we've been talking about The Key to Time because this, according to you, was one of the better seasons of Doctor Who in its history. And we've been watching the episodes and sort of summarizing our thoughts. For anyone who doesn't know, Barry has been watching Doctor Who since what, pre-VHS?
Oh, yeah, easily. Yeah. Since pre-cable, since the late 70s.
Gotcha. So faithfully for a long, long time. And I am more of a new Who fan. I started watching with the Eccleston series and have loved Doctor Who ever since. But I have not gone back and watched a lot of the old stuff. So Barry has been schooling me for the past couple years on... the old stuff. So this one, this is a Tom Baker series, right?
Yes, look, who many people feel is the best of the classic Doctors.
Yeah.
Myself included.
Yeah, yeah. And this is sort of the penultimate chapter of The Key to Time, right?
Yes, it is segment 5. Just to, in case there's anybody listening at all, let alone anybody who hasn't caught the last four. So The Key to Time is a 6-part season-long story where the White Guardian has charged the Doctor to retrieve these 6 pieces of this key, which will restore balance to the universe when placed in the right hands. And it enables the wielder to stop time completely, manipulate it, you know, give it a little fringe or so, a nice hat. So it's a very powerful device. Obviously, in the wrong hands, it would be disastrous. And the White Guardian, this ethereal being of goodness, tells him at all times, beware the Black Guardian.
Yes.
And he gives him 2 tools. He gives him a tracer device, which helps him find the keys. And he gives him a little girlfriend, a little assistant, Ramona Devorah Trelundar. In fact, my daughter was arguably named after this character.
Oh, God, yes, I remember. That little bit did sound a little sexist, Barry. that Ramona's a tool or a little assistant, but they will let that madman lingo slide a little bit. But
to be fair, she just graduated from the Time Lord Academy. She was only 140.
Yeah.
She's a kid. I mean, she's not, she's no less because she's female in this regeneration. Yeah. As we discover later in Modern Who, Time Lords can sort of regenerate back and forth between male and female, and who knows what other number of sexes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So basically the gist of it is that there is this thing called the Key to Time, which the Dark or Black Guardian, has spread across time and space. Actually,
the White Guardian did that.
The White Guardian did it so that the Black Guardian couldn't find it, right?
Correct.
And so this is his quest right now. He's been sent on this quest to recover all the pieces of the Key to Time. We haven't really been filled in on, like, why, like, what the White Guardian's going to do with it, or, like, what is the sort of Black Guardian's purpose, really, right? Like, none of that has really come up except for sort of like vague destruction of
the universe
or whatever. And
right.
And like you said, he's been given a tracker, and he's also been handed the assistance of the lovely Romana. Mary Tam is the actress who we've come to know and love. At least I have while being introduced to this series.
Oh, she's fabulous.
Yeah. So basically at this point, what was the last chapter? That was the one where they were on sort of like the medieval knights world, right?
The last one was, yes, the Androids of Tara.
Which had no androids.
Well, they had a few, actually.
Oh, okay. Sort of. I guess kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Every single person there had, like, a doppelganger. The king type person. They made an android version of the princess who looked a lot like Romana. I mean, there were androids aplenty. There were two.
Yeah, I don't remember being impressed with the amount of androids in it. I remember being like, where's all the androids? And like thinking that the androids are going to be like a major, like a huge plot thing, like androids trying to take over the planet or something. I don't know. But anyway, I remember sort of being a little bit not impressed with that chapter. And
You had Mary Tam playing four different characters.
Well, okay, that's great. Yeah. And that's sort of what we've been getting into, is that as this series Key to Time progresses, Mary Tam's character sort of becomes minimalized, at least in my eyes, more and more and more. She started off as kind of like this rowdy sort of spitfire that, you know, was going to give the Doctor like what for,
yes,
and not be bossed around.
She was very haughty. Well, yeah. I think she really started to take a back seat as early as the first story, the Ribos operation, when she thought that he was a bumbling idiot, but he conned the con men in the Ribos operation so handily, she was duly impressed.
Yeah. But I mean, even beyond that, she's become sort of, and even more so in this, the power of Krull, which is the name of the chapter that we're discussing. We haven't even, did we even say that yet? I think
we're trying to avoid it as much as possible.
Oh, no. But in this one, especially, she definitely comes across as more of sort of like a damsel in distress plot device.
Oh my God, the worst.
Yeah, and it's sort of getting to the point of where I realize why the actress sort of ended up leaving the show, because of the reading that I've done about her. You know, she was not satisfied. She was promised one thing, that the character would be sort of like the Doctor's equal. And as the show kind of went on, it's definitely obvious that that was not the case, that what she was being relegated to was sort of kind of as, you know, fetching and, you know, as intelligent as the woman was, the sort of character that she was playing was probably not up to snuff to what she wanted to be challenged with. Is that fair enough?
I think that's very fair, especially when you talk about this episode where the Doctor and Romana arrive on the third moon of Delta Magna looking for that piece of the Key to Time.
Yeah.
And before you could say Romana Dvorak Trelundar, she gets kidnapped.
Yeah, she gets kidnapped.
Again.
Yeah, this is like, is this the second or third time she's been kidnapped?
It's like the fifth time.
Yeah.
She's kidnapped in the Stones of Blood. She's kidnapped in the Androids of Tara. I think she was kidnapped at least in one other story.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's interesting because what's really funny is that from the beginning, when we started doing this, you like really hate the power of Krull. Like you despise it. Like like you're like, this is the worst. Like in messages that have gone back and forth, like with us via email or Facebook or whatever, however we're chatting, you are like, you despise this. So it's really funny because we were going to do this episode like months ago and something happened, like you weren't able to do it, and so we never got around to it till now. But
we did some other things in between.
Oh yeah,
we did the Flash. We did the CW
wrap up,
more timely stuff. I mean, this show is basically almost 40 years old.
Yeah.
So. But it's not like it can't keep.
No, I know. And that's why there's been not so much urgency, because obviously this is not like a strictly Doctor Who podcast. So I was fine with waiting. But not yet. But that wasn't... My point being was that I remember, and having rewatched it again, apparently the only place you can watch us now, at least streaming, is on Daily Motion.
Oh, really? The
quality's not so great. Yeah, it seems like that Doctor Who has been pulled off of, at least free streaming episodes, has been pulled off of Netflix, been pulled off of Amazon Prime, and that really sucks, because I guess word is that the BBC might be trying to do their own sort of streaming service or whatever, and I'm like, whatever.
Great.
That's just something else that I have to pay for. So in any case, the point being that I was trying to get to was that when I first watched it and have rewatched it now, I don't hate this. I actually kind of like it. I think it's fun. I think it's kind of in a crazy sort of like Ed Wood sort of way. I just really, really thought like... It swung for the fences in a way. You know what I mean? Is it like the greatest thing I've ever seen? Like, no. But I was expecting it to be just like extremely boring, like dreck. And to tell you the honest truth, I think I was bored by the Stones of Blood more than I was by this one. Like, this one at least kept my interest. So you've got to... let me know, because you really hate this, why you hate this chapter so much, because you've never really explained it to me.
Okay, so what I hate the most about it is that there is nothing new in this story that hasn't been retread from even older Doctor Who's. So, for example, the whole basic premise of the Doctor and companions showing up amid savages, and the swampies are
swampies.
They're clearly it's like a very thinly veiled stab at British colonialism.
Yeah, and American colonialism too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but this is a British show in the 70s. Yeah. I mean, they're still focusing on British colonialism.
Yeah.
But the way they had the swampies with their rituals, and the way that the mercenary was mocking them. I mean, this whole thing was as stupid as the Aztecs was with the first Doctor. It was very similar.
Aztecs, yeah.
And I mean, that's not even to belittle true Aztec or Mayan culture, because this is way stupider than that.
Yeah.
The chanting that they were doing when they were trying to summon Krull was really weak.
Oh, come on. Yeah, well, I mean, look, you look at it back. I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, come on, like, all the older Doctor Who episodes in general can be sort of typically a little silly, right? I mean, but this one, it's first of all, the swampies. So to get into a little bit of the plot, they show up on, what is it, the third moon of, what is it called?
Delta Magnus,
okay? And it's basically sort of like a swamp planet, right? And they are caught in this sort of... conflict between Earth colonizers, right, who are trying to mine the moon for methane, and these people, these creatures, people called the Swampies, who look like the relatives of the Jolly Green Giant. And like, I couldn't believe how much they look like the Jolly Green Giant. I kept expecting one of them to step out and be like, ho, ho,
ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, exactly. And so they meet these people called the Swampies. And obviously, at least to me, being an American, I was like, okay, these are sort of like the Native American stand-ins. This
sure.
is basically like, because what you find out is that Earth came to colonize their the original planet, Delta Magna, and they got pushed off of Delta Magna because the Earthlings wanted to settle there, and now they've discovered methane, or a source of methane on this moon, and now they're getting ready to try and move them again.
Right, they're getting kicked off the reservation.
Exactly.
To a shittier reservation.
Exactly. And it keeps happening. And there's this sort of conflict that's developing between the three people that are in charge of the mining operation and the tribe of Swampies that happens to be in their region. So, yeah, you've got that sort of thing happening. And like,
I mean, you also, so just as another borrow from an older episode, which isn't even that much older, this was season 16. This is, you know, you have the classic noble savages versus the technocrats. And that's an old trope, too. That was, we saw that in The Face of Evil in season 14, where we were introduced to the much more interesting character, Leela, you know, the savage warrior who becomes the doctor's companion, along with K-9.
Yeah.
So, and there, at least, you know, there's the Sevateem, which was Leela's tribe. At least they had women in their tribe, which makes sense. How come there are no female Swampies?
Well, we don't know what the Swampies are made out of. Are they plant people? Like, I don't know what they are. Like, they're just like these green, like with really weird dreadlock kind of like green wig. First of all, the design of the Swampies is absolutely horrible. They do look exactly like the Jolly Green Giant. But I mean, there's things that I really enjoy in this episode, which just, it's just kind of the all around silliness of it, and how seriously, like, I kept thinking watching this episode, like, the actors that play the Swampies, like, I was just, how mortifying must it have been to be in those outfits? And and I just,
work, like, is work.
I guess, yeah. But I mean, even having been an actor, you know, it's just like, there's definitely some roles where you kind of like look at yourself and you're just like, yeah, what am I doing here? And I kept kind of feeling a decent amount of respect for the actors playing the Swampies, because especially the lead one, what's his face, Rankin?
Yes.
They took it seriously. Like, they were like doing it, like they were into it. So I appreciated that sort of level of commitment from the actors. And
you know what they say, there are no small parts, only small players.
Yeah, exactly. And he played it to the hilt. But, you know, I sort of like the whole sort of mystery of like what Krull was, the sort of like discovery of the giant sort of swamp squid creature at the bottom. I definitely loved like when Krull first showed up and is this giant sort of Cthulhu-like, you know, squid creature on the horizon.
It's like the size of the Empire State Building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they say 145 feet high and about a mile wide, I think they said.
Jesus.
And for me, it was like, what I really enjoyed about it was that it had this sort of Godzilla vibe to it at points, where it was just like, you know, for the limitations that this show has on it, like, I was like, hey, they did a good job with that creature. You know what I mean? Like, they did okay. You know, I've seen a lot worse done on this show as far as like creature effects and stuff. So I liked the design of him. I liked,
well, it was nice that, you know, the Swampies were threatening a Krull sacrifice, and, you know, Roman is like, you know, you're basically, without saying it outright, your god is a myth. Nothing's really going to happen. And then all of a sudden, a little tentacle comes and taps her on the shoulder. So really, you think I'm a myth?
Yeah.
Here I come.
Yeah,
I'm big, I'm bad, I'm Crow, baby.
Yeah. I mean, having never really seen like the episodes that you're talking about, like I really sort of dug. I love the three guy dynamic in the mining, you know, community or whatever mining station, and I really liked sort of. It's really funny because I read a little bit about this episode on like on Wikia or whatever .com, and. I guess one of the directives of when they were developing the script is to get rid of a lot of the humor, but the Doctor has a lot of like really kind of funny quips, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That if you're not paying attention, they escape, but they're really funny. And so for me, this was like a really good episode that sort of focused on the Doctor. Romana was kind of pushed to the side a little bit, but it gave Tom Baker a little bit more time to shine and sort of like have his personality come through, you know.
He had a couple of great lines.
Yeah.
In this like, for example, one of my favorites up there is he says progress is a very flexible word. It can mean anything you want it to mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's telling that to the head of the refinery,
yeah,
to say that, you know, lots of people do a lot of shitty things in the name of progress.
Yeah. I mean, he had a lot of good like lines like that. I love the sort of
Tom Baker. I don't think he's ever done anything wrong in his life.
Well, I mean, either way, I felt like this series kind of gave him a little bit more time to shine than the past for me. I found myself like really warming up to him, where before I've liked him, but I've never really felt super drawn to him. Like, I've always felt like he's a little silly. And I don't know, maybe in this, he seemed a little more grounded, or maybe I was paying more attention. But I also loved the whole Ron Dutt thing, where he's like selling weapons to the Swampies so that they can fight the people at the refinery, but they're sort of like, they're decaying weapons, so they don't really work,
right.
And the Swampies don't really know how to use them. So there's all this kind of like a little bit of intrigue, like rolling in through a plot, which is set up to essentially introduce a giant Godzilla-like Cthulhu monster. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
yeah.
It really kind of played to the young kid in me that loved like Godzilla movies, and then the adult in me where it's like, oh, obviously this is about colonialism, obviously this is about, you know. And then it turns out that Ron Dutt is kind of like working, was he working with the people at the refinery? Because it seemed like he was trying to egg the Swampies on to a confrontation that they couldn't win. I mean, was that part of it? Because
I didn't get that sense.
No,
I got the sense more that he was just a piece of shit who sold them terrible weapons and didn't care if they got obliterated.
Yeah, I don't know.
He wasn't like a true. I think the name of the revolutionary group was the Sons of Earth or something.
Yeah, the Sons of Earth.
But he wasn't really working as one of them. He was just about to make a quick buck, and that's it.
Yeah, that I thought I understood that maybe that he was trying to trick them to help the refinery or to help the humans. But I guess maybe I read too much into that, or I made a mistake. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
But either way, I did like that little bit of sort of business, that there was this sort of like no good sort of scallywag on the planet who was trying to make money by, you know, taking advantage of the Swampies' ignorance. You know, so, I mean, there's just all this stuff that I recognize as part of, like, sort of our own country's history, you know, that that it was playing off of, and I really enjoyed it. Now, do I think it's, like, the greatest sequence of Doctor Who I've ever seen? No, obviously not. But I didn't despise it as much as you did. What I'm wondering is, like, did you always hate this, like, from the moment that you first saw it? Like, when you first saw it, do you remember when you first saw this series and, like, what your reaction was? Because you must have seen it, like, what, maybe on PBS or...
Yeah, like Channel 9 or something.
Yeah. Channel 13, back where we are.
Well, it was No, I mean 13 was PBS, but
yeah.
Channel 9 from Secaucus, the WOR. Used to show some episodes. I don't think I saw this one until later. Maybe Channel 21, WLIW.
But yeah, do you remember your initial reaction to it, or like, did you hate it back then?
I mean, when I was a child, I was a little more. I was so happy to see that. Oh my God, this is an episode I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Yay! But then, you know, as it sort of ground on, I was like, well, that was kind of stupid.
and the more
I watch it, the less I like it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've watched it twice, and the second time I watched it, I think I liked it even more. It's sort of like a kooky, you know, B movie, monster movie kind of way. You know what I mean?
There was also some terrible editing, though. Like, there was one scene when they are trying to boat away from the swampies right into Krull, but for some reason they didn't see Krull, and then in the very next scene they're like, look, and all of a sudden it's the size of the entire skyline.
Well, I mean, that could be played up to effects limitations, right? Like, I mean, it definitely seemed like, keep the thing still, make sure it's on the horizon, like, don't shake the camera too much, or you know what I mean. I definitely get what you're saying there, but that's the thing, is like, mistakes or like editing or stuff like that is something that's occurred in older Doctor Who episodes as well. So for me, I was expecting that sort of thing, you know what I mean?
See, to me, I guess this had basically every single one of the classic Doctor Who missteps all rolled into one story.
And what are those? What are the missteps?
You had bad editing, you had a bad monster, you had, two-dimensional sort of villains. You know, like the Swampies, you always have some sort of local group that's comes across initially as hostile, but then they come across, you know, sort of friendly in the end. Like, there was one episode, I think it was the Pirate Planet, when they had the Mentiads, right?
Yeah.
Those guys were kind of cool because they had these mental powers that they were able to derive from the planet Rybos, from the planet itself. You know, they had a little bit more depth to them.
Yeah.
And you had one of the son of one of the local ministers, you know, sort of took ill and became a Mentiad.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, the Swampies are just green.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, let me just say, like, there's nothing about this episode that struck me. I mean, maybe when it was made, that struck me as, like, wholly original or not completely derivative of other things beyond Doctor Who, right? Like,
right.
But it definitely hit. I mean, you know, we know each other enough, like, online, you know, like, what my tastes are. And it definitely hit sort of like the B movie, you know, kind of nerve that I enjoy. So I found myself getting more and more into it. And that's part of the reason why I do like a lot of these older Doctor Who episodes. They remind me of sort of, you know, because obviously I've discovered it in a different era, but they remind me of sort of like old B movies where it's like, okay, like maybe this isn't the greatest, but at least the story's interesting. It's kind of fun. Like this definitely, this sequence of The Key to Time definitely had me smiling, probably more than any other, because I was like, this is so ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe to someone like you who takes it maybe a little bit more seriously than
far
I do.
Far too seriously.
Yeah, where I'm like, okay, like, I can get why you're sort of disturbed, because I'm not disagreeing with you. Like, the Swampies are not. They are kind of dumb characters. I mean, it is a stupid looking tribe. The outfits and the design of them is, you know, I mean, you're talking derivative. I mean, they're derivative of a product spokesperson. Did they have like
right.
the Jolly Green Giant in the UK? I don't know, but somebody must have known about them because they looked exactly like them. What's interesting to note, it's like, as much as you hate it, apparently. the head, like, again, I just did some reading online before we started this. The head of the BBC series or serials hated the design, production design so much that he forbade the designer of this sequence from ever working on Doctor Who again.
Oh my God.
So you are justified in that, you know what I mean? At least like as far as like the look of the show or the look of like the Swampies. But
there were a couple of shining spots in the show, of course, because it is Doctor Who. Yeah. And even this much crap can't ruin awesome. And like, so for example, in the refinery, the guy who's actually not a complete scumbag, Dagheen.
Yeah.
I don't know if you recognized his voice. That's John Leeson, who is the voice of K-9.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I looked that up. And yeah, it's his only in-person appearance on the whole series, right?
Right. Yes.
That's great.
I think they did that because they realized that, you know, there's no way that K-9 could be used in a swamp.
Yep.
So he had to stay behind. But, you know, why? Look, Leeson's on the payroll. He may as well earn his salary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and that was really funny because among the three of, you know, the people in the refinery, he sort of definitely plays as the conscience of the group, you know.
Right.
Especially when...
We can't just kill them.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when the leader, Thawne, kind of like goes overboard and is like,
oh,
we've got to just exterminate everybody and everything. Like he loses his mind.
I mean, he also, especially when they, when even the refinery guys discover that there really is a giant squid, he goes all Captain Ahab on it. It's like, I'm going to blow it up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, not only is he going to blow it up, he's going to blow up the Swampies. He's just going to blow up everything.
Well, like, you know, because there are methane pockets everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And they try and warn him. And yeah, what's his name?
Wait, that's what... Wasn't that what was leaking in that big California leak? Wasn't that a methane leak?
Yes, it was. It was
God.
Methane gas. Methane was some of the stuff that escaped from the wells that are nearby my vicinity. Yeah, yeah, it was definitely that. So, but nothing was flammable, like in, or at least in that snuck out into the neighborhoods. But
right.
But yeah, he definitely wanted to blow up as soon as he found out that it existed. He wanted to blow up the whole thing, take the Swampies with him. So yeah, there was a little bit of that's sort of when you get to the climax of the series where like everything starts drawing to a head. But I mean, basically, yeah, you've got the Doctor. We haven't really talked too much about the plot so much, where the Doctor lands, they're looking for the Key to Time. Romana and the Doctor, they sort of split up, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah, and she, that's always a good idea.
Yeah, and she gets caught by the Swampies and she's taken in.
In short order.
Yes, in short, like right away. There's no time to waste. Listen, it's only like 20 minutes an episode. We got to move this thing along. She gets caught, and then as it goes on, she sort of is put up as a sacrifice to their god, Krull.
In the first episode, yes.
Yeah, in the first episode. And so there's this whole sacrificial episode. The Doctor comes and like comes to rescue her. Krull shows up, like, right at the... Or you see his claws
come
into the screen.
Well, right? No, because then it's really... Initially, in the beginning of part two, it's not really Krull.
Yeah.
It's a swampy dressed as Krull.
Yeah, exactly. Because Krull has not been around for, like, generations or whatever.
Something like that.
Yeah, and they basically use a stand-in dressed as Krull. And,
right.
Little do they know that the real Krull is about to show up. But anyway, the Doctor...
And he's pissed.
Yeah, yeah, he's pissed. Yeah. Well, the Doctor shows up to rescue Romana. And this is sort of one of the things that kind of bugs me about the whole Romana thing is that, you know, she really doesn't do anything like during the whole series to like help herself. You know what I mean? She doesn't...
No.
Add any sort of intelligence to the script. She doesn't add any insight to like what's going on. She's sort of just following the plot around and following the Doctor around, quite honestly.
I mean, look, her when she's tied up and about to be sacrificed, her scream is admittedly okay, but her face is saying, get me out of this job.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and eventually they get caught again, and they get put, them, it's the doctor.
This scene was one of my favorites, though.
Of course
this
it
is
was.
A highlight of the of this. It's certainly, to me, my favorite portion of The Power of Krull, and one of the better scenes in maybe the entire Key to Time.
Oh, come on. Wait, okay, so go into it, because basically they get captured with Ron Datt, the
yes.
guy who's been gun running by the Swampies, and the Swampies are like, this time, you know, we're really going to sacrifice you. And
you're not getting away.
You're not getting away. And there's seven ways to die, right? Seven sacrificial, I think it was seven, right?
I think so.
You are going to die by the worst one or something like that. And, we forgot about the fact that the doctor, right after he rescues Romana, finds sort of the Swampies, like, Bible.
Yeah.
Right? In a tunnel, just like abandoned. And it's like in perfect shape in this, like, you know, underground
swamp.
Yeah, exactly. And he's able to read it and sort of like discern the history of Krull. And,
well, you know, this actually, there's continuity for that, because he's rarely found a language that he can't decipher, in part thanks to the TARDIS. But.
Oh, no, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about that the page.
The fact that the book hasn't fallen apart yet.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but like he's reading the book and he's like, oh, I've come to the end. And he's so obviously like in the beginning of the book. Like he's like here in the end of the story. And I'm like, wait, that's you just opened up the book. So anyway, he gets his knowledge of Krull from that, and eventually they get caught again. And so what is this scene that
oh,
what so is there, it about the recaptured scene that you like so much?
There, it's so classic Doctor Who. It's their the seventh ritual of Krull,
where
they have these they're tied, you know, they're bound hand and foot by these vines, which when they dry just stretches them like they're on a rack.
Yeah.
But there's nothing mechanical about it. It's as the vines dry, they stretch out. And, you know, they're already feeling their back snapping, but they're left in this, I don't know, little room that has a skylight, basically.
Yeah.
And it's pouring rain. And the doctor starts, you know, like, he makes some like opera-like noises.
Oh God, that was ridiculous. And he shatters
the glass with his voice.
Yeah.
And it causes the rain to come in and drench the vines. They relax. He gets out, and then the tribe of Swampies run after the Dryfoots. Oh my God, that is classic Doctor Who. There was an episode where he was with Sarah Jane, where they were in some chamber where the oxygen was being evacuated, and he went into a trance that he learned from a Tibetan monk, where he would stop breathing so that she could have the oxygen. And it was like one of those like classic things, like, oh, I've been around for 750 years. I know a lot of shit like this.
Yeah.
So this was great. So
yeah.
That was a great classic. That was like I didn't see that coming.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I would imagine this is sort of like a trope of like the old Doctor Who, that he comes up with these abilities, right? Like
yeah,
out of his pocket
exactly.
that you
Instead,
didn't know about.
Right. Instead of, this is sort of like the modern Doctor Who's crutch reliance on the sonic screwdriver. Here, he was the sonic screwdriver.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I admit that, you know, and it's really funny because, like, when he sees the skylight and he's like, who put that window there? And he's like,
right.
The architecture in this building is absolutely horrible. He's like, you should fire whoever had it made, or something like that. And it's
right.
just like, oh, God, like, what is he babbling about? And yeah, he does this, which, you know, quite honestly, I found what you found brilliant. I was like, wow, that's really ridiculous. Cause he's like, ah! Like, you know, giving up. And I was like, wow, that is hardcore, like B movie, you know. And then the glass breaks and he gets everyone out. And, Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of like sort of like Batman, like with the bat shark repellent. You know, right. Let me pull out my bat. You know, just having anything in his belt like ready to go. But yeah, they escape and yeah, and then eventually you sort of get the Swampies sort of figuring out that there's some stuff going on at the refinery that is not good for them, correct?
Say that again?
Well, I mean, that there's basically goings on at the refinery that you know, that are not good for Kroll, not good for them, like that there's some craziness going on that could hurt the tribe, correct?
Of course, yeah. I mean, yeah. First of all, they don't trust any of the Trifoots. So, yeah. And, you know, the swamp, the refinery folks had actually taken some Swampies as house servants.
Yes.
And, you know, there was that one guy, Mensch.
Right. Mensch, yeah.
Which is a great, great name for a house servant Swampy.
Mensch.
Who dies, of course, but Kroll gets him, too. Yeah. Kroll is not interested in whether you're a Dryfoot or a Swampy. Yeah. He's hungry, and he's going to eat you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, at one point towards the end, Ranquin, the leader of the priest of the Swampies, kind of like loses it and is just like, we have to appease Kroll. And they sort of like raid the refinery, right?
And, yes, and they get on. They kill Thawne.
Yeah, they kill Thawne. And then Ranquin gets eaten by Kroll, which is like
but just before he gets eaten by Kroll, he refuses to let his faith in the monster be shaken, and he sees one of the tentacles. He begs it to destroy all the Trifoot.
Yeah.
And then instead Kroll grabs him and drags him to the water.
Yeah.
And eats him.
Yep.
And the rest of the Swampies are like, oh shit, okay. Well, let's do what the doctor says. He's got a big scarf and seems to know what he's talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that to me was like one of the greatest moments in the whole thing. And I believe I took a screenshot of the screen and sent you a text message with it. And I was just like, this is awesome. Because that to me just like said everything Ed Wood about like this particular sequence where he's like standing in front of the broken pipe and there's this obvious like fake, you know, rubber tentacle sticking out and this actor is just like giving it all he's got. And he's like, Kroll, you must destroy the, you know what I mean? It's just great. I loved it. I mean, for me, that just made me smile so much. It's just like, wow, that is ridiculous. Because especially the way they would get caught, like because the other Swampy that got eaten by Kroll in the same sort of room or pipe or whatever, you know, he gets the tentacle hits him. And he so obviously like turns himself or spins himself around to get
right. He has to jump into the pipe.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, this is classic. This is just great. So, I mean,
yeah, but it's no different from when, like, I don't know if you saw the Third Doctor episode, The Green Death, with the giant white maggots that basically couldn't do anything by themselves, so people had to sort of wrestle with them on their own.
That's awesome. So wait, what happens to Kroll at the end? Like, he doesn't get killed, right?
No, he doesn't get killed, but the doctor figures out that if he taps he taps Kroll with the tracer and the key piece. The reason why he's so gigantic is he's just like a normal squid that kind of gobbled up the piece of the key to time, and the energy from the key to time made him gigantic.
That's right. How did I forget that? I literally watched the episode yesterday. So Kroll was the key to time, correct?
He ate the key to time.
He ate it. Oh, he ate it?
Right. Gotcha. The piece made him gigantic. And when they touched the tracer to him, basically the the piece of the key came out, and then you were left with this, like, 6-inch squid.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's really interesting, because that leads to a sort of one of those moments where the doctor announces his age, where he's like, well, I've been around for, like, 760 years. Like, here we go. Like, he was, I don't know what he thought he was going to do to Kroll. Like, do you think he had figured out that he had eaten the key to time? Because
I think
like
so.
He's like rushing toward his death, you know, or just kind of like resigning to it. Like, well, I've got to try and fight this thing or do something. And then it ends up that he taps it with the tracer, and it turns out to be the key to time. I mean,
well, you think it was accidental?
Which seemed accidental, exactly. So, what was he trying to do to Kroll? Like, I don't know. It kind of was the doctor suicidal at that moment? Had he given up? Like, so that's sort of like a bit of a story loophole in there, don't you think?
I think it was, I believe that he had figured out that Kroll was, that Kroll had swallowed it.
So you think he had figured it out by that point?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he has to get close to the monster to touch him with the tracer, and that by itself is dangerous. But I guess he figures if I can just get in there and tap him with it, then it'll all be okay in the end.
Gotcha. Yeah, oh, okay, so, and there's, like, remnants of squid around, and he's like, oh, okay, these are pieces of Kroll, and Romana's like, oh, will there be another Kroll? And he's like, no, there's definitely not going to be another Kroll.
That's it. Right.
Because it was the key to time. So, I mean...
Right, that end. And the prop master was fired.
Not the prop master. I believe it was like the set designer or the production designer. He was fired.
But what's surprising to me, by the way, is the writer of this story, Robert Holmes, is one of the better Doctor Who writers. He's written a lot of great stories. He wrote The Deadly Assassin, which was a great story between the Doctor and the Master. He wrote a couple of other ones that are eluding me right now.
Well, according to Wikipedia, it says here, Holmes said that he considered the idea of a large monster a mistake given the budgetary constraints at the BBC and named The Power of Kroll as his least favorite Doctor Who story. So you have good company there.
He also wrote The Ribos Operation, so...
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah, I mean, apparently he was asked to write a story with a giant monster in it, which, you know, succeeded, you know.
He did that, yes.
Yeah. And quite honestly, I mean, I'm looking at the picture of Kroll right now. I think it looks pretty cool. Like, that, I could easily see Kroll squaring off with, like, Godzilla or something. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It looks like something that you would see in a Japanese, kaiju film, which for people who don't know what kaiju is, it's basically what those monster sort of movies are considered in Japan. It's called kaiju. So he looks like a really cool kaiju to me. I mean,
right. But, you know, I guess to me, the villains on Doctor Who were always life size. They were always the Master. They were always, I mean, the Daleks are really scary. And they're like, 5.5 feet tall. I mean, there are a lot of them, but, you know, they never really had any giant monsters. I guess, you know, that makes the Power of Kroll a little on the unique side in the Doctor Who pantheon, in that most of the monsters are not 100 feet tall and 2 miles wide.
Yeah. Well, which makes sense, because how do you sort of combat something like that, right?
Right.
But, and obviously Kroll isn't given any kind of sentience or anything like that. So, you can't, like, outthink him like maybe the Fantastic Four did to Galactus in the comics a long time ago.
Really, we never really know what Kroll's motivation is.
No, he just wants to eat. That's his motivation.
I can't blame him.
And he's woken up by the mining operation, correct?
Right. Yes.
Yeah, by the methane refinery.
By the vibrations from the machinery.
Yeah, but he's woken up by it, but then the vibrations are also sort of like what helped defeat him, because at the end...
Well, they confuse him, yes. Like, there's the doctor asks the refinery crew, turn on all the machines so that he's like really freaked out.
Yeah. Yeah. So he doesn't like noise. He's awoken from the bottom of the swamp by all the...
I can empathize.
He's awoken at the bottom of the swamp, you know, by all the noise or activity of the refinery. And and at first he's sort of like a big mystery to the refinery crew. But in the end, ends up being this giant monster who turns on the people that worship him, eats a bunch of them, and kills their main high priest. That's kind of wraps it up. I mean, it's really interesting because there's four episodes of this, and it's a very sort of simplistic story, you know?
Yes, they could have done this whole thing in 90 minutes.
They probably could have done it like in three episodes or something like that, but, you know, Romana had to be captured at least twice. It's interesting to me how much, you know, she is kind of wasted in this sequence. I mean, she just kind of stands around and, you know, talks about plot points and then gets kidnapped a lot. You know, is she considered like a really great companion or?
Yes. Okay. She's awesome.
But why? Just from that first episode? Because after the first episode, she sort of, like I said, becomes... I mean, besides the fact that she's kind of fetching and has an air of intelligence about her, you know, in that first episode, after that first maybe series, she's really not...
She's eye candy.
Yeah, she's eye candy, and she's sort of, like I said... damsel in distress mode.
Well, and typically that's the job of the companion, is so that the doctor, instead of muttering to himself, who needs to explain things to us stupid human viewers, he can explain it to his stupid companion, who is usually an Earth person, but, you know, typically, but in this case, she's a Time Lord like he is.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have to explain as much, but, you know, I guess because she's so green, she's never really been off Gallifrey, she's so young, she doesn't have any real world experience, he's always having to... It's like, you know, that classic cop buddy movie where you've got, like, the older cop gets a new rookie partner.
Yeah.
And he's explaining everything to him.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that even... in those rookie cop movies, there's a dynamic. And,
yeah, where the rookie isn't completely useless.
Yeah, and even in Doctor Who, the companions are never really, at least the modern day ones, in my opinion, have never been completely useless. And, you know, this is the first time I've sort of seen a companion. Well, it's sad to me because it sort of degenerates as the series goes on, where at first she's like interesting, kind of like, you know, smart, very smart, and, you know, not, and sassy, not ready to take any guff from the doctor. And then she just sort of steps into line and becomes a bit of a bore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
well, but, I mean, I guess I'm my opinion is colored because I so greatly enjoyed the next the regeneration of Romana as Lala Ward. Because there, she's spunky as hell.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I wonder why they did that then, because, you know, it would seem to me that they would say to Mary Tam, like, hey, you know, we'll clean up the writing. But in any of the reading that I did over the weekend, it seemed like she couldn't convince them to sort of, like, punch up the character. And then
Maybe they punched up the character because she left.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, holy shit, she left. She quit. We better make this character more interesting.
Maybe.
And, you know, they made her so interesting that Tom Baker married the actress.
Oh, really? He married?
Yeah, they were married for like a year and a half. Yeah.
Oh, that's all bummer. That's interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, so I think the power of Kroll, to me, was kind of one of the more fun sequences, but for different reasons than what they usually are. Like, for me, it was like, just how crazy can this thing get? You know what I mean? Or just how ridiculous can this thing get? And it got plenty ridiculous, especially anytime I laid my eyes on a swampy. I swear to God, I was like, oh, wow. Like, these guys, this is like hardcore, like, this is bad, like weird.
Asparagus gone bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so I think that for me, this sequence, it's interesting. I know it's trying to take itself seriously.
That's the problem. I mean, if it were trying to be funny, then I think it would have gone over much better.
But that's why it works for me so much, is that it's trying to take itself so seriously, and I'm watching it and thinking to myself, come on, you can't honestly be taking yourself seriously. Where other episodes, they take themselves seriously, there's humor and stuff like that, but, I mean, there's a part of me that's still going, like, come on, you can't be taking yourselves that serious. Like, this one, it seems like it's so ridiculous, or it goes off the rails so badly that I just had to enjoy it. You know what I mean? Where I think where you were more like sitting there like, this is ridiculous.
What the hell?
Yeah, exactly. Where I was just like, what the hell? How crazy can this get? This is batshit insane. You know what I mean? From the outset, from the Swampies, from the concept of the Swampies, to the dudes having to put the green makeup on and that stupid wig that they had on, I was just like, I was in. I was like, all right. Where's this going? You know what I mean?
So no place good.
So for me, it was the silliness that kind of helped it a little bit. But you, would you say this is kind of like one of the ones that you hate the most?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't hate it too much because it is Doctor Who after all. But I would say it's among my least favorite episodes. I can tell you that in a 2009 poll in Doctor Who magazine, of the top 200 stories, this one ranked 174.
Oh, you know, that's interesting because there's also that ELO episode that people...
Yeah, but I like that one.
I love that one. That's like one of my favorite ones.
People hated that one.
Yeah, people hated that one. So maybe I should watch the episodes that people hate and those will be the ones that I enjoy. You know, I don't know, but...
But you see, that one was clearly... Oh, yeah. Trying to be funny, yeah. And it succeeded.
Yeah,
brilliantly.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that to me is definitely one of the more fun ones, and mostly because it was just sort of thinking outside the box. You know, where I was like, "Wow, this is completely different than any of the other episodes or anything."
The Doctor was barely in it.
Doctor's barely in it, but I don't know. There's something about Kroll. There's something that Tom Baker did during this. During this part of the series that made me really kind of warm up to him more so than any other one. So I don't know. Maybe it was that Romana kind of got like pushed to the back, you know? I mean, there's that episode, remember we've talked about with Matt Smith where he moves in sort of with the heavyset guy and what's her face barely in it. I totally am blanking out on the redhead's name.
Amy Pond.
Yeah, Amy Pond, where she's barely in it, and it gave sort of like Matt Smith a moment to shine. So like Romana kind of got...
You know, that pudgy guy is James Corden.
That's right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Oh, wow. Good call.
Which I didn't even realize that he was, quite a successful Broadway star.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
You should look for Carpool Karaoke. He does that.
Oh no, I've seen
online.
Those. Yeah, yeah.
So
he
does a really brilliant one with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Audra McDonald and Jesse Tyler Ferguson. It's a Broadway karaoke.
Oh.
It's so great.
I will have to look that up.
I mean, yes, he has a great voice. He's got a great presence. And I'm watching this. I didn't realize this. So like my mouth drops open. I was like, I didn't realize Stormageddon's father could sing.
That's funny. I have to look out for that. But so do you have any sort of final thoughts on Kroll besides the fact that he's an awesome looking monster?
I think that... You know, like you have a great idea, like The Key to Time, and you've got six stories, and you've got each story has between four and eight parts to it. One of them's going to suck, and it had to be this one.
Oh, that's so funny.
It's almost as though, like, you know, that pause before the grand final note in a symphony, which is the The Armageddon Factor. The sixth piece of The Key to Time.
All right.
That's great.
We are going to do that one next, and we're going to do it sooner than 6 months, for sure. Yes. Maybe next month, for sure, because I definitely want to see how great this thing is, because you've been raving about it for as long as we've been talking about this, and I know that there were some segments of The Key to Time that you liked more than others. I think maybe the second or third one you didn't like too much either. There was definitely one where you were like, can we skip this one? And I was like, no, we're going to do the whole thing.
I'm pretty sure it was this one, Crawl.
No, there was one before this where you were not too crazy about it either. But I'm glad that I saw Crawl. I mean, there's one series of Doctor Who that I saw early on when I first discovered the new ones, where it's like a bug on a satellite, or it's like a bug-like creature.
Yeah, the Ark in Space.
Yeah, I hated that one. So this, to me, is better than the Ark in Space. So I just remember being really bored by the Ark in Space. And for this, at least in my...
Oh, but that was a tense episode. That was, you didn't know when the Wirren were going to sneak out and bite you. You know, it was very tense.
I don't recall. Maybe to a little boy, Barry Negrin, there was, but to me, I just remember being very bored by it. So
that was actually one of the first episodes I ever saw.
Oh, well, so see, there you go. But for me, at least Crawl had a little bit of momentum that kept it going and kept me actually interested in wanting to
watch. They actually shot it outside a little bit, whereas
that's
the
true too.
Space was all in the studio.
That's true too. That's true too. So, all right, so we're going to do the Armageddon Factor next, and then you've got to figure out some other old episodes, because it looks like we're not getting any new Doctor Who for a long time, right?
I think till Christmas.
Till Christmas, which totally sucks, but...
Sucks!
Yeah, and then when does Moffat leave?
He's doing season 10, then he's out.
And then he's out. Okay, well, I think it's time. As much as he's contributed, I think it's time for somebody new to step into the role of showrunner. Well, all right, so this has been... what is this? The sixth? Oh, the fifth.
The fifth
part of The Key to Time, known as The Power of Crawl, which I enjoyed, but Barry despises more than the Doctor despises a Dalek. So, you know, I will leave it up to you. It's on Daily Motion. The quality is not so great, but if you want to check out some classic Doctor Who and decide whether it sucks or it's great,
I feel like, you know, as the intellectual property attorney on this conversation, you could always buy the Key to Time.
That's true. Actually, I should say, you're absolutely right that that it is available on Amazon for $8. And I almost bought it, but I didn't have enough time to get it shipped to me. So I was looking to see if it was on Netflix, and I couldn't find it, and I managed to find it on Daily Motion. So yeah, the DVD is like $8. I mean, I literally almost bought it because I was like, okay, I got to get this, but it just...
Oh, wait, you didn't want to get the entire Key to Time special box set? I think it's a collector's item now.
It's like $125, where you could buy like each sequence for like maybe $5 to $8. So maybe I'll do that if I ever want to revisit them. But I may have to buy the Armageddon Factor, because it doesn't look like that's streaming anywhere either. So in any case, find a way to watch The Power of Crawl. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email us at ptf@parttimefanboy.com. You know, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on Facebook, blah, blah, blah. And leave us a review on iTunes. My name is Christian Horn, and I am here with Doctor Who scholar Barry Negrin. And this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening.
Part-Time Fanboy.